the end of our 10th annual lecture series with Book Passage, and I can't imagine a better way to conclude a great 10th year than to have Senator Elizabeth Warren joining us. So, welcome. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Mary Marcy, and I'm the president at Dominican. And I will be brief because I'm pretty sure I'm not the star of the show. But I do want to make a few brief announcements. You need to know that the Leadership Lecture Series is part of a partnership with Book Passage, and it's also made possible because we have a remarkable sponsor, Private Ocean Wealth Management, which is led by a member of our Board of Trustees, Richard Stone. We brought a dozen lectures to you this year. Because of their leadership, we've been able to expand the lecture series. Private Ocean has been named 7 times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisors nationwide. It's because of their lead sponsorship and their community-mindedness that they are a good partner for us, and they have allowed us to considerably expand our programming. The Marin Women's Commission also returns each year to support a leadership lecture series that matches its mission and its values. Our institute is celebrating our 9th year in partnership with the Marin Women's Commission, and we're guided by the mutual commitment that women's leadership effectively helps implement change at all levels of the community. Now, beyond these important thanks, I want to make one last important thanks, which is to students, staff, and faculty volunteers who help make all of this work and who you have seen managing the crowd and everything else today. Please join me in thanking them. If you haven't already, you might want to fill out a card with a question for the senator, because there will be a chance for questions at the end of her talk. And to introduce the senator, I am pleased to introduce Richard Stone, who is the founder and chairman of Private Ocean Wealth Management, and as I mentioned, a member of our Board of Trustees. He has been practicing for 40 years in wealth management and has been awarded the prestigious Charles Schwab Impact Leadership Award for his lifetime contributions to the financial planning industry. Or, as we talked about backstage with the senator, he's one of the good guys. So on behalf of the university, I would like to express our gratitude to Private Ocean for their support of the Leadership Lecture Series. Please join me in welcoming Richard Stone.
Good afternoon. We're going to have some fun. Senator Elizabeth Warren's life was shaped as a 12-year-old girl growing up in a small town in Oklahoma when her father, a janitor, suffered a heart attack and her mother took a minimum wage job at Sears to protect the family. Elizabeth, who took work as a waitress in her aunt's restaurant, experienced her first financial crisis. That is what spurred Elizabeth to evolve into a fearless advocate to fight tooth and nail for the middle class. Fast forward to 1992. That's when Senator Warren began teaching at Harvard Law School. 3 years later, she became the Leo Gottlieb Professor of Law at Harvard. Then Senator Warren received a phone call from Washington, D.C. to help advise Congress. She was appointed to the National Bankruptcy Review Commission by the Clinton administration. In 2008, she was appointed to chair the 5-member Congressional Oversight Panel created to oversee the implementation of the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act. The Boston Globe called her the plain-spoken voice of people getting crushed by so many predatory lenders and underregulated banks. Time magazine called her a new sheriff of Wall Street for her oversight efforts. In 2011, at the age of 62, Senator Warren announced her candidacy for the U.S. Senate for the seat formerly held by the late Ted Kennedy. In 2012, she won the general election to become the first female senator from the state of Massachusetts. She was assigned to the Senate Special Committee on Aging, the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, and the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. Senator Warren is the author of 8 books. This afternoon, she comes to Dominican University to discuss her latest book, A Fighting Chance. Please join me in welcoming the senior senator from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren.
Thank you very much. I am delighted to be here this afternoon at Dominican University. This is just it's a great place and a great place to come and have a chance just to stand here and visit with some people. I am also delighted to be here as a part of the lecture series that's been supported by Book Passages. You know, I look at a good, strong, independent bookstore, and I think of it like a good, strong, independent woman. You can't keep us down. So I'm happy to be here. Want to make sure everybody can hear me, including in the back row. You can always tell a former teacher, I will be keeping an eye on you in the back row. I always know who goes to the back row. There will be a quiz following this lecture, so you may want to take some notes as we go along. Really, I thought what I'd do in our time together is I talk with you just a little bit about the book. I tell you what's in the book and read a couple of passages from the book, and then we just do questions and answers for as long as we've got time to be able to do that and try to cover whatever it is you'd like to talk about. So I'll tell you a little bit about the book. The book is very much a personal story. And it's a personal story in the sense of my life. It's a personal story in the sense of the things I witnessed firsthand. So the book opens up when I'm 12, as Richard had said. Now, by this time, we're living in Oklahoma. We've moved from Norman to Oklahoma City. My daddy was selling carpets. We'd had some ups and downs, but he's working. He's selling carpets at this point. I was the baby in the family. All three of my brothers by this point are off in the military. I have three much older brothers. My mother always called me the surprise. I was about 30 before it hit me what that meant. I was sure she meant that in a good way. But I was what was for those days known as a late in life baby. And so my mom was a homemaker full time. She'd never worked outside the home. My daddy's selling carpet, and that's when he had a major heart attack. And a long period of time, he was in the hospital, and then a long period of time with no money coming in. And so the bills stacked up. We lost the family station wagon, and we were right on the edge of losing our home. And I remember the day that I walked into my mother's bedroom, and she had pulled her best dress out of the closet, and she was struggling to get it on, to get that zipper up. Dress was probably 15 years old. And she pulled up the zipper on that dress, put on her high heels, and walked to the Sears to get a minimum wage job. Because in those days, a minimum wage job would keep a family of three above water. And that's what my mother did for us. She saved our house. My daddy got back to work. He eventually ended up as a maintenance man. Mom kept the minimum wage job. We steadied out, but there was no money for college. I ended up married at 19, baby in my early 20s. I graduated from a commuter college. It cost $50 a semester. Yeah, think about that. And opened a million doors for me. And then when my daughter Amelia was 2 years old, in fact, it was on her second birthday, I hauled off and decided to go to law school. I know, it was just an amazing thing. First of the family to graduate from college, and here I was headed off to law school. I had a vast experience of law and lawyers. I had seen them on television. Hey, how hard could it be, right? And and they only represented innocent people who really needed help. So, but going to law school was actually fabulous. We get up every morning, Amelia and I would, and we both had backpacks, and we put our backpacks on, and we'd head off, and I'd drop her off with the babysitter who kept a bunch of kids, and I'd head into law school. I went to a state school, headed into law school. And then I'd pick her up about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we would tell stories. And her stories would be about, you know, the boy who smeared chocolate pudding in his hair. And I would tell a story about the professor who called on a coat hanging in the back of the room. True stories on both sides. And we would laugh hysterically. We were buddies in the things we did. And that's where I thought I might pick up this story and tell you a little bit about it. So one morning, Amelia was sitting in her booster chair at the kitchen table eating cereal. I popped a few pieces of bread in our toaster oven, got busy doing 6 other things, and quickly forgot about the toast. When I saw smoke pouring out of the toaster oven, I grabbed the handle, pulled out the tray, exposing 4 slices of bread that were on fire. Not smoking, I mean flames shooting up. Always a quick thinker, I screamed. Then I threw the tray at the kitchen sink. 3 pieces of toast hit the target, but the 4th went high, setting the cute little kitchen curtains on fire. I screamed again. And then I grabbed Amelia's cereal bowl and threw it at the burning curtains. The milk doused most of the fire, and I calmed down enough to realize that throwing things was probably not my most effective strategy. Then I noticed the toaster itself was shooting sparks and seemed to be on fire. How long had that thing been on? So I got a glass, filled it with water, took a deep breath, and poured the water on what remained of the flaming curtains. I grabbed a towel, beat on the toaster until everything seemed quiet. It cooled down and I could unplug it. Now that may have been the year that I started so many kitchen fires that Daddy gave me a fire extinguisher for Christmas. Back then, our toaster oven had an on-off switch, and that was it. On was on, which meant that it was possible to leave toast under the little broiler all day and all night until the food burned, the wiring melted, and the whole thing burst into flames. At some point, and I have no idea exactly when, someone had the idea of adding a timer and an automatic shutoff. Huh. These simple changes made it a whole lot harder for distracted mothers or anyone else to leave the broiler running until it set the kitchen on fire. 30 years later, while working on an article about how the government could protect consumers from predatory financial companies, you like that segue? Woo, smooth. You didn't see that coming, I can tell. I thought about those old toaster ovens. By then, it was all but impossible to buy a toaster that had a 1 in 5 chance of bursting into flames and burning down your house. But by the 2000s, it was possible to refinance a home with a mortgage that had a 1 in 5 chance of costing a family their home and putting them out on the street. In fact, it wasn't just possible. Those mortgages were bursting into flames all over the country. Why the difference? The United States government is the difference. By 2007, the year I was writing my article, a government agency actually monitored toasters for basic safety. And if anyone tried to sell a toaster that had a tendency to burst into flames, the agency would put a stop to it. In fact, government agencies ensured the basic safety of pretty much every product offered for sale. The agencies worked to keep us safe. No lead in children's toys, no medicines laced with rat poison, no cars without functioning brakes, and no exploding toasters. But in 2007, there was no government agency that would stop the sale of exploding mortgages. So that gives you a little taste of what the book is about. It's a lot about the personal, and it's a lot about what was happening in America at the time. I tell a lot of stories about growing up, about being a young mother, about starting a career, but the basic thread of my story is America's story. I'm the daughter of a maintenance man who ended up in the United States Senate. But here's the key to that sentence. I worked hard, but I grew up in an America that was investing in its kids and creating opportunities like that. In fact, let's just talk about that America for a minute. I just want to talk about that America. I want to talk about an America that coming out of the Great Depression, think about this, a worldwide depression, a depression across this country, America made two extraordinary decisions as a country. Ones we don't talk about so much anymore, but ones that were powerfully important to who we became. The first, it put strong rules in place to help level the playing field. The basic idea was there's a cop on Main Street to make sure nobody steals your purse. There should be a cop on Wall Street to make sure nobody steals your pension. That's the idea. America followed other basic safety regulations. Safe drinking water, safe medicine, and as I said, safe toasters. But that was the idea. We put safety rules in place so businesses could get out and compete, but against a background of a level playing field and a lot of safety. Second thing is America built a future. It built a future for our kids. How did we do that? Well, we did it by investing in education. I mean, big time. The GI Bill, the NDEA loans, the money that was pumped into our universities and colleges. America had the idea that if we invested in education, our kids would have more opportunities to build something for themselves, but that we would all benefit because they would build a stronger and more robust America. That was part one. Part two was that we invested in roads and bridges and power grids, all that basic infrastructure. What was the idea behind that? The idea was, we didn't know who was going to have the next great business idea, but we were pretty sure they were going to need to plug in. They were going to need power. They were going to need to get their goods to market. They were going to need educated workers. They were going to need this basic infrastructure. So we built it together so that whoever had that idea for that really cool idea or that expansion could do it and could flourish and create jobs for all of us, for our kids. Third thing we did, and this one is extraordinary, it says something about us as a people. We invested a piece of our money in research well ahead of the rest of the world. We invested in medical research, in scientific research, in engineering research. Why? Because we believed that if we built a giant pipeline of ideas, that our kids would figure out things to do with those ideas that their parents could only dream of. We made those investments. We built a future. We built a middle class. And you know what? It worked. For more than half a century, as America's families got richer, our country got richer. And here's the deal. As our country got richer, America's families got richer. It worked for all of us. And then, about 30 years ago, the Republicans had a different idea. They said, let's push this country in a different direction. And here were the two core ideas. The first move, take the cops off the beat. Not the ones off Main Street, just the ones on Wall Street. Let those big banks load up on risks. Let them build a business model that's based on tricking people and trapping them. Make deregulation the watchword of the day. The second idea, cut taxes for those at the top. Open up huge tax loopholes for big corporations. Let billionaires keep more of their money. And how are we going to pay for that shift in our budget? Well, the answer was cut the investments. Cut what we spend in education, in infrastructure, and in basic research. We lived with that for about 30 years, and then we saw what happened. Banks and other corporations made huge profits, and billionaires kept more of their money. In other words, the rich got richer, and the powerful got more powerful. Meanwhile, the middle class began to crumble. The economy crashed, and our kids may be the first kids in American history to do worse than their parents did. So I pick this part of the book up again in 2009. It's after the crash. I was in Washington, and I was working furiously on two things. The first was fighting the big banks over the TARP bailout. And the second was fighting for a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, still thinking about that toaster from 30 years earlier, and determined to stop the big banks that cheated families by loading up credit cards and mortgages and payday loans with tricks and traps. I wanted a level playing field. I wanted this agency to be part of what became the Dodd-Frank financial reforms. I just wanted a fighting chance for America's families. Now, this next part's really going to surprise you. The big banks didn't like the idea of the agency. They took some exception to it. In fact, they took so much exception to it that they made it their number one goal in the financial reforms was to kill the consumer agency. Not modify, trim, kill. You can actually look up the words, the number of times they said, we will kill this agency. And boy, did they put their money behind it. For 2009 and on into 2010, they spent more than $1 million a day lobbying Congress to weaken financial reforms and kill off the consumer agency. So I'm going to pick this story up at the point where we've gotten the agency up. I've been in Washington fighting for it along with others. We've gotten it just barely through the House of Representatives. Democrats were in control of the House, and we've gotten it through. And now it has gone over to the other side, to the Senate Banking Committee, and that's where I pick up. It was Friday morning, January 15th, 2010, and the calls started coming in early. I was at home, up early, to work out on the treadmill in the basement, and I was still huffing and puffing when the phone rang for the first time. Had I seen this morning's Wall Street Journal? The rumors were flying on Capitol Hill. The consumer agency wasn't going to make it. In an effort to move the larger financial reform bill forward, Senator Dodd would trade it off. Oh, there might be some face-saving attempt to set up a new consumer department somewhere else in the government, but there would be no strong, independent agency with the authority to get much of anything done. The insiders sent the word out, too bad, so sorry, it was a good idea, but unless the agency was dropped from the reform bill, the whole package of legislation would fail. Better to toss the consumer agency overboard and get those reforms through. I listen. So this was it. The consumer agency was dead. all the families who'd been cheated by the big banks and the credit card companies, all the hard work by Barney, the consumer groups, Heather, Dan, the president, all that knocking on doors and all those meetings, and now it was coming to an end. So I asked if there would be a vote, even a losing vote, but the answer was no. The death wouldn't be a public execution. Instead, the Senate Banking Committee would propose a financial reform bill with no consumer agency in it. No one in the Senate, not a single Democrat or a single Republican, would have to vote against the agency. Instead, it would just be suffocated quietly in its crib. No one would ever know exactly who killed it or why. So I ask my last question. When? How long before the locked-in version of the bill would be introduced in the Senate Banking Committee, with or without the consumer agency? Best estimate, 3 weeks. The deal wasn't finalized on other moving parts, and it would take a little while for those to be worked out. So I picked up the phone. I called Dan. Dan's my former student and my wingman in Washington. And I said to Dan, we've got 3 weeks. Because the way I saw it, we had nothing to lose. I didn't want a job in the Capitol, so what did I care if I ticked off a bunch of people in Washington? This was our last chance to get the agency into law. If we lost it now, we lost it forever. We had very little information about what had led to the latest assault on the agency, but we did know one thing. The Senate did not want a tough vote on this issue. Dan explained what that meant. The consumer agency was popular, and to a lot of senators, a vote on the new agency meant having to choose between angering the public and angering the banks. And they didn't want to anger either one. They preferred a quiet and slightly mysterious death for the agency. So I figured, too bad. Too damn bad. If a bunch of senators were going to pick the banks over families, then the American public had a right to know. And if we didn't win, at least we could make one hell of a stink. So that's where it goes next in the book. Now, here's what I see and what I talk about in the book. Washington works for those who can hire armies of lobbyists and lawyers. For the rest of America, not so much. Look, I saw it up close and personal with the big banks. They cheated American families, they crashed the economy, they got bailed out, and now, right now today, the big five financial institutions, the ones we were told back in 2008 were too big to fail, are 38% bigger than they were at the time of the crash in 2008. They still swagger through Washington. They block reforms and push around agencies. And look at it this way. A kid gets caught with a few ounces of pot and goes to jail. But a big bank gets caught laundering millions of dollars for drug cartels, and no one even gets arrested. The game is rigged. It is rigged. It's rigged, and it's not just the big banks. Look right now at how America, how the federal government makes choices. Think about this. Our college kids are getting crushed by student loan debt. We need to rebuild our roads and bridges and power grids. We need more investment in medical research, in scientific research. But instead of building a future, This country is bleeding billions of dollars in tax loopholes and subsidies that go to the rich and the powerful. Many Fortune 500 companies, companies that make big profits, pay zero in taxes, and billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries. What have they got? They have lobbyists. Lobbyists and their Republican friends in Washington, and they make sure every rule tilts in their favor. That's how Washington works today. The game is rigged. The game is rigged, and it's up to us to do something about it. So the question is, what? Well, we can whine about it, we can whimper about it, we can complain about it, or we can fight back. Me, I decided it's time to fight back on this. We have to fight back. And that's what this book is all about. It's about fighting back in a rigged game. It's about fighting back to level the playing field. Now, a lot of folks are going to sit here and say, yeah, but that's hard. Yeah, I'm like, no kidding. You know, if it were easy, somebody else would have already done it. But I want to tell you one more little part to the story. That little consumer agency, the one that the banks worked for over a year, spent more than $1 million a day lobbying Congress on, and who knows what they spent on campaign contributions and everything else, right? That little agency got passed into law, a good, tough version of that agency. Yeah, yeah, you bet. You bet. And before you have that moment, 10 minutes after you get home and you say, I was applauding over an agency, let me make this a little more real. That little agency has been in place for about 2 years now. It has already forced the largest financial institutions in this country to return more than $3 billion to people they cheated, tricked, and trapped. Not bad for an agency. That's a difference. So, I learned firsthand, change is hard. I learned firsthand, you go into fights and boy, as this book will document, I lost a lot of them. But I'll tell you this, every single fight I came out of on the other side, I was smarter and I was tougher. And yeah, you do not want to meet me in a dark alley. But that's really how I see what's in front of us right now. We have come to this moment in history where the playing field has been tilted, where the rich and the powerful have worked the rules so they just keep getting richer and they just keep getting more powerful. And everybody else is left to hang on by their fingernails. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to get up and fight back? I plan to fight, and I'll tell you why. I wrote this book as part of that fight. I wrote this book out of a deep sense of gratitude. Gratitude to my mother and my daddy, who worked hard all their lives, who ended up with very little, but who knew that all four of their kids were going to do better than they did. And for them, that was success. I wrote this book out of gratitude to an America that believed in a minimum wage that would keep people out of poverty. An America that believed kids who work hard and play by the rules ought to have a chance for an affordable education. An America that believed that nobody, not even the biggest financial institution in this country, was above the law, and there was accountability for everyone that broke the rules. I wrote this book out of gratitude, and I wrote this book out of determination. Determination that we are going to fight back, we are going to level the playing field, we are going to once again build a world where every kid gets a fighting chance. For me, that's what this is about. That's it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, thank you. See you up there. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So now we're going to do questions, right?
We are.
Okay, I will take big bad banks for 400, Alex.
Okay, we got it. And to the audience, I just want to say thank you all for being part of this today. I feel that we're at something historic. And as you leave and you get your book, having read the book, you are in for a great night tonight.
Ah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The first question is, we know that you have recently filed a bill about student loan debt.
Yes.
And there are quite a few of us here who have questions about student loan debt. Could you just talk a little bit about how you see this debt, how it affects the middle class and our economy as a whole?
Sure.
And where we are.
Thank you. I would love to talk about this bill. So here's the deal. People now owe $1.2 trillion in student loan debt in America. Think about that. That is more debt than any other form of debt owed by individuals other than mortgages. It's more than credit cards owed by everybody in this country. Car loans, all of it. Not only that, it is exploding exponentially. Over less than a decade, student loan debt went up by 71%. It's just going through the roof. And it is starting to have a measurable effect on individuals and on enough of them that it now has it on the whole economy. So what we're starting to see is young people can't move out of mom and dad's place. They're not saving up money for down payments. They're not buying homes at the rates that we would expect for 30-year-olds and 32-year-olds. They're not buying cars. They're not starting small businesses. They're not making the purchases we would expect. And it is beginning to have a drag on the economy. Don't take my word for it. The Fed has weighed in. The Treasury Department has weighed in on this, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and Janet Yellen just talked about it in a hearing on Thursday. So this is an economic emergency, what's happening to America right now. We just have this giant student loan debt. And let me, actually, I have to just give you a couple more. I will sound like a college professor. God, how did that happen? You know how many people have outstanding student loan debt right now in America? 40 million. 40 million people are dealing with student loan debt. And we talk a lot about young people, and it is the right way because it is, that's where the measurable impact. But just so you know, people over 60 collectively owe $36 billion in student loan debt. Why? Because they co-signed for beloved children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews. And here comes the real kicker in that one. The federal government garnishes Social Security checks to pay off. And it doesn't matter. Social Security is all that stands between you and poverty. Still get their slice for the student loans. So think about what this means. Now, let me tell a bigger story around this. $1.2 trillion in student loan debt and the interest rates outstanding right now for people who got their loans 3 or 4 years ago, 6%, 7%, 8%. I actually could do this with numbers. Raise your hand when I hit your number, right? 9%, 10%. The interest rates on student loans are enormous, and they can't be refinanced. So you refinanced your home mortgage, good for you. You refinanced your business loans, good for you. Even the towns have refinanced their municipal debt, but not kids who owe student loans, all right? Now we're going to come to the last part. That's the, if nobody is ready to riot by the time we get to the end, then I have not done my job. Because here's the part you need to hear. How did those interest rates on student loans get set where they are? How are those numbers working? So the interest rate on student loans covers the administrative costs. I get that. It covers the bad debt losses. I get that. It covers the cost of the funds. I get that. And then that number, depending on what year you came through, is doubled or tripled or quadrupled because the United States government is making tens of billions of dollars in profits off the backs of people who have tried or are trying to get an education. Just the slice of loans from 2007 to 2012, just that little cohort, the ones that were issued in that year set, according to a report that came out from the CBO last month, just that little slice is on path to yield $66 billion in profits for the United States government, to run the government. So, pitchforks and torches will be on sale out at the edge. But here's what makes this story so important, because I want you to think about what this means. So I've got a bill that I just proposed last Tuesday. It's not even a week old. Think of it like a little baby chick, okay? It's just starting to fluff up. It already has 29 co-sponsors. Woohoo! Okay, I'm happy. So I've got this bill, and what this bill says is that we're going to reduce the interest rate on student loans down to a number. Now, understand this on the number. Down to a number that's a number that the government will still make a profit. It'll just be a whole lot skinnier than it was before. But it happens to be a number that last July, when the question about doubling the interest rate on new student loans came up and it was all in the press, nearly all of the Republicans in the Senate and the House and a majority of the Democrats all voted to this set of numbers, 3.86% for undergraduate loans, a little higher for graduate loans and plus loans. So it says, let's pick those numbers that everybody just voted for and let anybody who wants to refinance public or private loans bring them in and refi down to that number. That's what we want to do. Can I do one more on this? I know it's a long answer.
Yes.
But this story just keeps getting better.
Keep it up.
So the fact that a profit has already been baked into these loans means if you reduce the profit, you've got to find a way to pay for it in the budget. So hear me on that. Not only is the U.S. government making money off the backs of the students, when the money comes in, they don't say, woohoo, surprise, money. No, it's already been built into the budget. For years into the future is, oh, we're going to keep turning the crank on all those people who have student loans at 11% and can't do anything about it. So the pay for, that is, you refinance down, the pay for is the Buffett rule. It says we stitch up some of the tax loopholes that lets billionaires and millionaires pay less in taxes than their secretaries. We take that money and we use it over on student loan refinance. So, this is the next fight in Washington, and I'm ready. We're going to have fun on this. Yeah. Okay.
One more question.
All right, one more question.
Some time ago, you were on a PBS special where you showed us how regulations got stripped to allow the banks to legally steal from us, through credit cards. Mm-hmm. What can we do as citizens now to work with you on this.
So this is, boy, somebody watched a PBS special and remembered it. God bless. Because that's a long time ago, I think, if it's the story, if it's the one I'm thinking about. They are, yeah. So here's the deal. This is the way the world works out in ways that, right? The mysteries of life. So I didn't get to stay and run the, spoiler alert in the book, I didn't get to stay and run the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I was pretty disappointed. And I talk about it in the book. But I did end up going back to Massachusetts and running for the United States Senate. And now here's something that's really cool. So I won. That's a very good thing. And yes. And I now sit on the Senate Banking Committee. The same committee. And I have learned that there are more tools in the toolbox when you're in the Senate than a lot of people thought. Sure, there's the thing we learned in seventh grade civics, how a bill becomes a law. And yeah, there's a lot of gridlock in Washington around that. And we can talk about that. Student loan bill is going to be straight into that. And that's what we're going to pound on them about. We got to move that piece of legislation forward. But the other part of this is the regulatory part. There's a lot of law out there. There's a lot of good banking law, but regulators have to be willing to pick it up and use it. So I have another job in life, and that is to remind regulators they do not work for the banks, they work for you. So that's going to be a big part of this.
This is, somebody asked a question that I didn't really know. It says you used to be a Republican. Is that
true?
Is that a fact?
It's true.
What happened?
No. Actually, I've been all three. I was a registered independent when I lived in Texas. I was a registered Republican when I lived in Pennsylvania. And I've been a registered Democrat ever since I've lived in Massachusetts. And no, it is not the water. It's because, and I think this actually is fairly clear in the book, I was just never very political. And I kind of, I know, it's hard to believe now, you know? But it's true. For me, I was never because you have to remember, the story goes back a long time, in the 60s and 70s, even into the 80s, I wasn't very attuned to much about politics. I was grateful that I had grown up in an America that invested in our kids, but I don't even know that I could have articulated it in that way at that time. My life's work has been about what's happening to America's middle class. I've worked on this as a professor for more than 25 years now. And I have watched every year. I have documented, because I'm a data-driven researcher. Every year, America's middle-class families just get hammered one more time. And I could just, don't get me started on this, about what's happening. No, I'm serious. On income, on housing, on education, on transportation, on health care, how families have just taken one punch after another after another. They have done everything they can to try to respond, to try to stabilize themselves. The median family in the United States back in the early 1970s had one earner in the workforce, you ready for this? And had enough money after buying a home and putting kids through school to put away 11% of their take-home pay in savings. Yeah, by the early 2000s, the median family in America had two people in the workforce, had zero savings, and was head over heels in credit card debt. Why? Not because, as so many people wanted to say, ooh, too many trips to the mall, too many fancy sneakers, too many microwaves. There was like some guy who just kept going, well, but everybody has a microwave now. Yeah. And they cost $99, jerk. You know, it's not that families aren't working hard enough. It's not that families are overspending. Now look, it's not that there aren't people who don't make mistakes. And oh, let's be sure to highlight every single one of them. I'm talking about what's happening in the middle. And the answer is the ground has shifted enormously. The world looks different from how it looked a generation ago. You know, those of you in this audience who are my age, we can sit around and tell our kids, well, we did a great job because I got here and I have a house that's fully paid for and it all worked for me. No, the world has shifted. And it hasn't shifted because of some force of nature. It has shifted because policies in Washington have shifted. For half a century, every law that was written in this country from the Great Depression to the 1980s was run basically through the filter of will it strengthen America's middle class? And then the question of, and will it help people lift themselves out of poverty and have a shot at making it into the middle class? That shifted in the 80s, and it shifted to how it is that the rich and powerful can just make things work a little better for them. And that happened at the expense of America's middle class. And I'll tell you this, we're running out of time. If we lose America's middle class, we become a fundamentally different country. We become a fundamentally different people. And that's what's at stake. That's what's at stake right now. And I have no idea how this question started, but that's where I'm going to end it.
And boy, do I love it. Yeah. We'd love to stay all day, but the senator is going to need to get a plane soon. She is going to sign books. If you, on the way out, the Book Passage staff and the Dominican volunteers will help everybody get that signed book.
Wait,
that came with your ticket.
Are we through?
We are never going to be through with you, Senator Warren.
Okay, so wait. wait. If I'm not going to get to answer any more questions, I want to say one more thing.
Great.
Okay, is that okay? Okay. And I really do appreciate it. I appreciate this, Elena. Thank you very much. Okay. And thank you all. I wish I could stay and shake hands and talk with everybody. I got to catch an airplane. But I really do want to say this about what this book is about fighting back. It's not about railing against the wind. It's really not. It's about understanding in a smart, tough way what's broken and what we're going to have to do to fix it. Because big picture, here's what it looks like to me. We really do live at a moment where, I don't know how many more ways I can say it, the rich and the powerful, they do. They've just got armies of lobbyists in Washington. The influence of money in Washington is worse than you think it is. However bad you think it is worse than that. No, it's scary. And I talk about this in the book. It's not just contributions. It's the fact that they just have these enormous resources just to keep going at. Why this little rule? Let's just change three words in here. Let's just change two words over here. Let's just do just a little bit here and a little bit there. And just over and over and over. We keep opening more loopholes, more subsidies, more opportunities for those who have already made it big. And that comes at the cost of every kid who just wants to try, just isn't there yet, just wants a chance to get out there. So they've got all the advantages of money and power on their side. What have we got on our side? We got two things. We've got our voices and we got our votes. And we've got to use them. We've got to use them. That student loan bill, tell me what kind of an America would say, we're going to scrape tens of billions of dollars a year out of the pockets of young people and middle-aged people and seniors only because they weren't smart enough to be born to parents that could write a check up front for college. Think about it, because who is it who pays? You pay one price if somebody can write a check. You pay a higher price if you have to borrow the money. So they're going to scrape. What kind of a country says we're going to scrape tens of billions of dollars out of their pockets so that we can afford to keep loopholes open for those who have already made billions of dollars? That is not who we are as a people. And if we don't get organized around these issues, I don't care, we can put labels or names or whatever else we want to put, but around these issues, around minimum wage, around student loans. By the way, go to Bank on Students. That's what it's called, bankonstudentsbill.org, one of those. It's probably org. But look it up, Bank on Students. Get organized online. Sign those petitions. Give those $5 checks. Forward it to your friends. Be part of groups that are organized. We have got to make our voices and our votes count, because America is running out of time. Our middle class that defined this country, that solid, boring, always there, but always full of promise and opportunity. The kids who worked hard, who played by the rules, had a chance that our kids were going to do better than we did. We know how to make that happen. But at this moment, it comes down to us to make it happen. And the way that happens is we have to take this country back. We have to take it back so that everybody in this country gets a fighting chance. Thank you all for being here. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Fantastic.